strips citizens of their rights for essentially putting across ideas that they don't like. In fact, on any subject, I mean, you've hardly even spoken about Ukraine. You've, like millions of European people, you've been angry, and through your journalism, advocating, if you like, for Palestinians or right to protest over Palestinians, and that's essentially why you've been sanctioned. So if your case is allowed to stand, it essentially means the European Union can strip anybody of their rights without any due process.
Exactly. Like, my case right now is a precedent case. If, as my lawyer said, you're holding the Pandora's box closed, and if you leave that now, that Pandora's box is opened, and it's doomsday in Europe. And we can feel that this fear is working in Germany, because there is extreme self-censorship of journalists, of politicians, and activists. They're not talking about it. Personally, they talk with me. It's so horrible with you what happened, but it's too hot for me. And this is the aim. The process itself is the aim.
And is that one of the reasons they went after you? Because I have the same experience as you. You know, obviously, the last few years I've been known for my criticism over NATO policy over Ukraine, but I speak to mainstream journalists privately. They say very different things than they do publicly. But is that one of the reasons you think they've gone for you? Because if you silence one journalist, if you kill one journalist, you silence hundreds or thousands more. And is that? Do you think what's happened to you has had a chilling effect on German journalism?
Yeah, what happened to me has a chilling, has an extreme dangerous effect, not on the journalists, but on the entire society and the political spectrum as well. It is something that is legalized by the European Union that gives all the possibilities to do that. So the governments itself can execute all of that by referring to the European Union. A, impunity, like the German government says, we did not do that, it's the European Union. And therefore it becomes like legitimized for them. And they will, they're extending these more repressions more and more. And that has a chilling effect. That has an effect of fear. That has an effect of what the liberal journalists described happening in Iran, happening in China, happening in Venezuela, these authoritarian regimes. But this is even far worse here. For example, I'm someone with a Kurdish background. I know all the political experiences and the repression in Turkey as well. In Turkey, they do it, the repression, without having a legal ground. Here in Europe, which is more dangerous, they have a legal ground now. They can refer to the rights, to the regulations of the European Union, and to emergency situations that they create themselves, and have a legal base for it. And this is, I think, the most dangerous, and it will attack in the future. Working class people want to strike, journalists who want to write, musicians who want to perform arts, which the government does not like anymore.
And so there are increasingly other cases in Germany, the UK, Europe. I don't know whether you know that George Galloway, I'm sure you know who he is, very recently has gone into exile because he was detained as he got off a plane in London. There are other cases, my own case. do you feel, and these seem to be, it's difficult to know whether criticizing Israel or criticizing NATO policies on Ukraine is worse. But do you fear that with your journalistic colleagues and around Europe that there is increasing authoritarianism and a fear of extreme repercussions for speaking out?
Yes, we can feel that everywhere. If you, as a journalist, have no trade union backing you up, in contrary, being part of that repression, if you have mainstream journalists who are becoming now the mouthpiece of the governments here by starting disinformation campaigns. I mean, we saw the best example, it was with me here in Germany. My sanctions are technically the result of a disinformation campaign of mainstream journalists here. Or we saw it when Jeremy Corbyn, a couple of years, was attacked by mainstream media for being anti-Semitic. We saw the whole atmosphere created by the 10% of media outlets that there is an imminent threat for us, that Russia or someone else will attack us. That creates that authoritarianism. This is part of the authoritarianism, because governments use media to enforce or control information. And that's the dangerous side. Like, the information that I gave is not wrong. Like the best example, I interviewed Hamas representatives. That was categorized by the European Union and today by the German government as giving terrorist organizations a platform. The very same Hamas politician was interviewed by German mainstream media. That was okay. So that shows me it is not about if the information is right or wrong. It's about having the monopoly on information to influence the society. This is what they're afraid of, especially when you have journalists like you or journalists like in England that we saw from Electronic Intifada, SF Incident, I think it was, whose house was raided. And across the board, Richard Medhurst, for example, it's about if you have these little cases of journalists which you can't control, then you need to suppress them with all the means necessary. And it is, in the past, it was only the police, military, or the government itself, but they have now found a better tool, which is their own, which I call now state-funded independent journalists, or the foot soldiers of their politics today.
Because it seems crazy, that this is one of my major points, that suppressing these journalists, and I know most of the people you've just mentioned, I'm sure you do as well, that there's some outstanding journalists out there who are all too often just correct in their work. Those who criticized Israel at the start of what happened in Gaza suddenly become more mainstream. The realization that what Israel is doing actually is not also not in Western interests. And indeed, for example, my work on Ukraine, I warned the West or NATO that they would fail in Ukraine, the counteroffensive would be a failure. And now you said that there should be peace. That is changing. It seems that closing down journalists have they perform a civil duty. And the idea that Germany shouldn't be blindly supporting Israel, the idea that Germany or the European Union should not be blindly supporting Ukraine, it's very easy to make that case, that it's in European interests not to do these things. And it's journalists like yourself who are stating that. So to silence them and shut them down, in my view, is simply not in German or European interests. It's damaging European interests by silencing someone like you.
I agree. I think it is not about European interests anymore. It's about the interests of certain capitalist interests. It's about the interests of certain military-industrial complex. It's for lobby organizations. If you look today, especially Germany praises have never again, never again, never again. If they mean never again, it means also for the most oppressed people right now in Germany, which are the Muslims, which are the migrants, which are people of color, which are Palestinians especially. I think this rhetoric, never again, upholding democracy, is used to push certain political interests. I don't believe that Germany, for example, is supporting Israel because of the historical guilt. That is non-existent today, because before October 7, there was a sharp rise of anti-Semitic attacks by the far right here, but we don't talk about that. I think Gaza is a good, or October 7, the prison break of October 7, was a good opportunity to push their interest, to regain interest again in the Middle East, which they lost. I mean, pre-October 7, the influence of the West in the Middle East was almost non-existent, except the US. Now they have the opportunity to go in, now they have to push or they can push certain political and military interests as well. I mean, we know that the whole thing that happened in Syria, it was not about Assad or not Assad. We know that the attacks on Iran is not about to bring back democracy in Iran. It's about step by step opening up the way towards China as well, to the bigger threat, economical, political, cultural threat. I think these are little elements that they use today to go for a long strategic political militaristic plan, and that you can see being reflected in the European politics. Rearm Europe. Germany wants to spend 500 billion into military. Everyone needs to spend more for militarization. But those who talk about unemployment here, about housing, about economical crisis, they're being shut down. And these journalists, it's been you, it's been me, and it's been others as well. So we should not talk about the misery that this system here created, but we should look at the supposed threats that come from Asia and Middle East. It's a distraction for me. yes, we have problems around the world, obviously, but we need to start here. We need to start to fix things in these countries before we bomb other countries, like it is a European tradition to do so.
And so what do you plan to do now? I mean, I know you've had some quite important support from some European MEPs, Yanis Varoufakis, the famous former German economy minister. You have got some...
Greek economic minister. Greek,
what did I say?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so sorry. Greek economist, economic minister. So you do have, you're a very respected journalist. You do have some support. But what do you plan to do now? I mean, is it difficult living now? You're carrying on your work as you can. But what do you plan to do? Do you want to take this to court? How are you going forward in this?
Right now, we submitted our case to the European Court of Justice, which will now review our case and then decide at some point if there will be a hearing or not. Sometimes the European Court of Justice decides without a hearing yet it was wrong or right, etc., etc. But before submitting our case to the European Court of Justice, we asked, because that's the process, you need to ask the European Commission to rethink the sanctions 3 times, and they said no, it's legit. We did no mistakes, as the German Foreign Ministry spokesperson said. Germany does no mistakes. They literally responded to the journalist's question about me. Say no, we don't do mistakes. So we are waiting. That can take 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 4 years. We don't know. But there is a danger in that, as former European Court of Justice judge wrote in her report. Every 6 months, sanctions are reviewed. It sounds very good, but it's a danger because, again, there is a mechanism there. Every 6 months, they could sanction you again for another reason. While I'm fighting that, then another case opens up. So I could be in a limbo for years and years, maybe a decade. We don't know.
Especially as you're carrying on your work. So you don't know, you could say something or do something, they decide, well, we don't like that either.
Exactly. Just me complaining about that my case is not covered in the media, was a reason to keep my sanctions. That was officially used as a reason, because that was disinformation for them. I'm still working, but I think all the newspapers who are in solidarity with me, they're kind of happy because they don't have to pay me, because they can't pay me right now, it's forbidden. You can be charged up to 5 years, I think, for that, going to prison. But I need to work because it is important, especially during times when the oppression is the highest, to inform people about that so it does not happen again. And this is my understanding, never again is now, by standing up against that.
Because I think your case really is a deeply important case for the future of Europe. If it's allowed to carry on what's happening to you, then it will happen to other people. Do you fear for the future of freedom of speech in Europe?
I think the future is already now. I do fear. It is dangerous. It is very... It reminds a little bit of the dark times in Europe in the 30s. It reminds... And there are parallels to that. I don't say it's the same, obviously not, but parallels do happen. I think it was before Hitler took power, or short after that, don't nail me on the ear, like 36, 7, 38, there was a law brought up by the Nazis called Schriftleitergesetz, which meant that newspapers or the editors-in-chief needed to report benefit, like in how do you say that, in line with the governmental interests, otherwise they could be arrested, prosecuted, or killed. Today, they don't kill you, literally, but the EU says. And that's the whole definition of sanctions as well, which is quite creepy. Sanctions are designed to change your legal behavior with a view to promoting the objectives of the European Union and its foreign security policy. Like, it is the same, if you want to be very...
what shocks me about this is that European policy, foreign policy, is clearly doing huge damage to the European states and the European people. If you look at the policy on Russia and Ukraine, even if the most pro-Ukrainian supporter would admit that European policy has been a disaster, it's caused huge damage to European industries. And so now you've got to this cycle, this damaging cycle, where you can't criticize European policy, even though European policy is wrong and it's damaging European interests.
I think it is a design cycle. Again, I will do historical comparisons here. What is happening today, because you mentioned a couple of times that what is happening today, or what European Union does today, is technically damaging the European economy, the European society, and you're right. And that happened also before Hitler took power back then. And Europe was, or Germany was, in an economical crisis. Its car industry, its industry, manufacturers, it was all in a crisis. And then Hitler came, took power, or they gave him the power. And he changed the whole industry into a militaristic industry. And this is what we're seeing today. We see, I mean, if you look at the statistics of the German government and the news about, from the last 2 years, the car industry, which was the heart of Germany, is collapsing. It is compared to others around the world. And now they need to change that industry into something that is bringing you profits. And what brings you more profits than war? Because if you're an active war, you need to buy weapons. Look at Germany's Rheinmetall. It was, their stock price were before the war in Ukraine on the bottom. Now it's skyrocketed. You can't even buy, I don't know if you are into stocks, but you can't even buy that now. There are billionaires, trillionaires today. And if you look who is benefiting from that crisis, I think things get very obvious. It's not the people in Europe. It's not the people in Russia, China, or whatsoever. It is these companies. It is these military-industrial complexes that benefit from it. That's why they want and need the war.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost 5 children, 3 of which are biological, 2 of which are adopted. They were orphans, and we took them in and were taking care of them. The 5 of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre, it made our call known to the whole world. So remember, in all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our religion. They knew what happened. Remember, in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that celebrity?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers' Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about four times the rate of South Korean workers.
Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that, among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A historic day in Iraq, as the Iraqi government officially announced the end of the mandate of the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq, UNAMI. After more than 20 years of its presence in the country, this comes in the light of improved security and political stability, which will allow Iraq to transition from direct international support to managing its own internal affairs.
In my view, the presence or absence of UNAMI mission makes no difference to Iraq, especially since this organization receives direct support. Unfortunately, most of the so-called international humanitarian organizations have turned into tools controlled by the United States. The evidence is clear. We have seen repeated interventions in Iraqi affairs. UNAMI had specific objectives, defined mandates, and legal and diplomatic mechanisms. But what we witnessed went beyond that, reaching direct political interference and intervention in Iraq's political decision-making.
Despite UNAMI's long presence in Iraq, political analysts believe the organization did not fulfill its true role. Instead, it influenced and interfered in political decisions, failed to manage affairs effectively, and consistently leaned toward the American side, failing to convey the suffering of the Iraqi people.
The truth is that the United Nations, through its representations worldwide in recent years, has failed miserably to be a clear mirror reflecting the suffering of people. Instead, it has turned into a tool in the hands of the United States of America. In Iraq, the UN representative reflected a specific agenda and exercised a form of imposed guardianship over the Iraqi state. As a result, the mission was only able to achieve the objectives pursued by the United States while attempting to place pressure on the Iraqi state.
This is a historic day for Iraq as UNAMI's mission ends and a new era begins, one characterized by the Iraqi sovereignty and the prevention of interference in internal affairs.
A new phase begins for Iraq with the end of the United Nations assisting mission in the country. This doesn't mean the end of cooperation with the UN and is aimed at further asserting Iraq's sovereignty without any foreign intervention. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine. This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration. The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them. Even during last Christmas, I remember how churches were bombed into rubbles.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel, Smotrich, and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine.
And their policies are neo-fascist. They talk about annihilating all the Palestinians, the women, the children, everybody. There's no reservation about it. And Netanyahu follows this, partly because he's ideologically inclined.
With churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus and hundreds of thousands of people murdered, it will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old. Okay, I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office, okay? Other countries through mass protests like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up in nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low and down from 40% as recently as March.
Because a lot of people don't believe in politics, don't address it, don't see it, but they do see what's happening in the pocketbook, in their own reality. And that's the usually first thing that people address, Americans address.
Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars.
Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
For many Syrians, Israel's latest remarks reinforce a belief that the threat extends far beyond Syria's borders. The statement is widely viewed as an open declaration of hostility toward the region, rather than mere political rhetoric.
This entity threatens the entire Arab world, not just Syria or Palestine. We aren't afraid, but there must be a broader popular response, especially by Arabs. Sadly, people's reactions remain slow, while some governments align with Israel.
Syrians also connect these statements to recent Israeli incursions in the south, including the attack on ByteGen. Many view these events as early indicators of a dangerous shift that may eventually demand decisive action.
This regime won't stop at Palestine. It wants full control of the region in order to control all the resources of its people. It has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
this year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Thank you. Good morning, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Audio Shelf. Today I'm going to read to you parts of the book Unwithering Flames about Shahid Abbas Babai. Please stay tuned. Abbas Babai, born December 5, 1950, assigned to pilot training in the U.S., 1969 to 1972, married to Malihe Hikmat, August 26, 1975, martyred on August 6, 1987, Sardasht. Stay a bit longer. It seemed like truth and death were two sides of the same coin, and the man had found truth. On the night of the departure, over 100 people had gathered in our small house to say their goodbyes. Abbas asked me to go to our old house with him, which wasn't far from our new house, formerly the base's power station. We went there to exchange our last words. There were some things that he wanted me to do while I was away. Tears had covered his entire face. I didn't want my departure, the moment of our separation, to be bitter. "Take care of yourself if I'm not here when you return," he said. I had heard this before. I couldn't take it anymore. How could I bear your absence? How could you not be here? My love for God is the foundation of my life, but you have become a beautiful and important part of it. I yearn to be with you, and I believe that together we can build a relationship that honors both my devotion to God and the love we share. I hope that my love for you will never ever conflict with the love for God. Abbas said this with tears still resting on his face. I went quiet. What could I say? I was busy mulling over my trip, and he, Malihe, one who has found his divine love, must leave all else behind, he said. He continued, "Let me watch you as you walk." Huh? What do you mean? I asked, confused. I want to see how you look in your ihram. I walked around and he looked at me like he was looking at me for the first time, like the night when he and his family came to ask for my hand in marriage. That's enough. People are waiting, I said. No, let's stay a bit longer, Abbas replied. Just when we were about to leave the house, he went and brought me one of my shirts, a long-sleeve violet shirt with a floral pattern made from a light fabric that my mother had bought from Mecca. "Wear this there," he said, while handing me the shirt. When we got home, everybody jokingly asked us why these conversations of ours took so long. The buses were waiting for us at the mosque. All of the other travelers were friends or colleagues of Abbas, along with their wives. While in the front yard of the mosque, Abbas pulled me aside. Knowing how much I loved peaches, he had bought some just for me. It felt like the early days of our engagement all over again. We found a quiet corner and savored the peaches together. When the kids approached us, he gently told them, "Go to your grandmother. I want to be alone with your mother." The bus was waiting for me. All the other passengers had already boarded. Finally, it was time for us to part ways. There was a man standing next to the bus reciting Maddahi and Salawat. "All recite a salawat for Shahid Babai's health," he suddenly said aloud. My feet couldn't move any longer.
This is Audio Shelf on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
I turned and asked Abbas, "What is he saying?" "This too is God's work," he said. My legs couldn't move. I took a step ahead, but my worries were dragging me back. When I boarded the bus, I couldn't make sense of any of the other passengers, even though they were all my acquaintances. As the bus started to move, my eyes were fixated on him, the one who had boarded the bus to send me off, and I started crying. I switched seats with Ms. Ardestani so that I could still see him when the bus moved farther. The thought of this being the last time that I would see him made me uneasy. For the last time, I saw him from the window as he looked up and smiled. He had one hand on his chest while he was waving at me with the other. That was the last moment I had of him, forever etched in my mind. After all these years, I still remember that final smile. Now, I've grown used to him being present and me unable to see him. I know he's watching over. He's with us, and he protects us. Without his ethereal presence, I would never have been able to endure the difficult life I faced after his martyrdom. Sometimes, I hear him knocking. I can even hear him cough sometimes. Before my daughter was married, she used to see him often. Just before she got married, one of our family friends came and told us that a bus had been visiting him in his dreams. A bus had told him that there was a suitor for our daughter, and had even told him the groom's name, all of which came true in the end. I lived with Abbas for 11 years, and I'm still living with him. Even when he was in America, he thought of me as his future wife, unbeknownst to me. Although he is no longer with us anymore, he is still my husband. Sometimes I get palpitations, and that's when I feel his presence and even catch his scent around me. Now I know why he was so insistent that I find a job. Every time I ring the bell as principal at the school I work at, I drown myself in the kids' childish clamor.
Stories about famous martyrs of Iran in Audio Shelf. Only on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
The Pious Pilot, Northrop F-5 Pilot Training Camp, Reese Air Base, Lubbock, Texas, USA, 1971. Intelligence Report, Abbas Babai, the Iranian student, is described as abnormal in his file. He performs daily prayers. At a time when everyone bragged about their debauchery and partying all the time, he stayed away from such things. He had even gone to the extent of limiting his interaction with his drunken roommates by splitting the room with a cord. He didn't even drink Pepsi. He said, "The company supports Israel." When the commander of the airbase, Colonel Baxter, returned to his office, he was met by the young man he had summoned. The young Iranian's face looked familiar. The colonel remembered one night when he was coming back from a night of partying with his wife, when he had seen him running into the courtyard to purge the devil from within himself. And now the young man was bowing and prostrating over the newspapers he had laid out on his office's floor. Later, when he finished his prayers, he explained that this was one of the obligations of his religion. Since the colonel had not yet arrived, and that specific moment was the time to perform his prayers, he performed his prayers. He spoke English slowly but fluently. That interested the colonel as he studied the rest of the reports in his file. He looked at the young man. His pictures from back then displayed a young man with a handsome face and stubble. He was wearing a thick leather belt around his jeans and was sitting happily around a formica table with his friends. The colonel approved his file. Abbas was now a pilot. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us with this episode of Audio Shelf. We hope you enjoyed parts of the book, Unwithering Flames, about Shahid Abbas Babai. Don't forget to log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Till another episode and another story. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Salam, O Muhammad. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
وما كان